Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. The following is a talk given by Nick Rochford, founder of the legendary Compendium Bookshop in Camden Town, London. This was recorded at the Conway Hall in summer of 2008.
One person with £1,000 can manage to make a profit over a period of time buying cannabis, and another person pisses it against the wall in no time at all. And they do exactly the same thing, but somehow one person makes it work and the other person doesn't. But so that's just part of the natural abilities that people have, business-wise, I suppose. But anyway, every business that I came into any contact with, except possibly with the exception of Oz magazine, and that was probably because the people involved, certainly Neville, were journalists. They had journalistic experience before they started the magazine. So they were actually continuing the skills and the career, if you like, that they already had. Whereas the other people, like myself, were starting from scratch. I didn't bring to bookselling a training in selling or a training in bookselling or anything like that. So we were more sort of just wheelers and dealers looking for a way to fit in, and also a thing that that people wanted to join in. Everybody was looking for a way to join in, and the more successful you were at joining in was defined by the way in which you were 24/7 involved. You know, you didn't want to be part of the straight world. You didn't want to have a straight job. You wanted to somehow make your way within the culture, and quite a lot of people, to them, that the only way to do that was to buy and sell, or to render a service of some description. So with us it was bookselling, because we were involved very much in books. It meant something, they were important. The books that were, you know, were being read in those days, the books of, you know, Lang and Ginsberg, all the books we all know now as sort of iconic, Trocky, the rest of it, were coming through and making a big impression. I, for one, certainly, when I read these things, believed in them and felt that there was something there which, if you could make it available to other people, then you might be able to achieve something. You might be able to spread some knowledge. You might be able to help and also get a way into something which seemed to exist but didn't. There wasn't a door. Basically, there wasn't a door. You had to find your own way in. We were lucky. I mean, a lot of people messed up. The fact that we happened to come upon a shop in Camden Town instead of somewhere else, you know, there were some several shops around Charlotte Street that we looked at. If we'd taken any single one of them, we would have gone bust within 6 months. We didn't. We took this little shop in Camden Town that had been a cafe. We had a hell of a job even getting someone to give us a lease, because we were both, 21 or something. They didn't want to deal with 21-year-olds, you know, they wanted the guarantors and all the rest of it. And we scraped about, and I think we gave them £500 instead of a guarantor, because my father refused to do it. Took me to his solicitor, who read me a lecture about how it was a very bad investment. So we didn't, you know, we did it that way. With this £2,000 that we had, basically. We're trying, as I say, to join in. We went to the Anti-University, which was something that followed directly on from the Dialectics of Liberation Conference in the Roundhouse, George Farm, which was a spectacular sort of rollerback of success and failure. A lot of the Dialectics of Liberation conferences evenings, which I didn't actually go to, broke up in sort of riots and arguments and all the rest of it. There was a series of records called Stream Records, which are white records with the Moog printing on the front, and they are nearly all of the talks, the lectures that were given at the Dialectics of Liberation Conference, very few of which you see now. You know, you might be able to pick up one or two on the internet somewhere, but they got a very bad distribution. And Stream Records, who put them out, who also did a series of poetry records after that, went bust fairly sort of reliably a year or so later. And I think the couple that did it went and run a monkey sanctuary somewhere afterwards. And I wish I knew where they were. You know, if anybody knows anything about that, I'd really like to hear from them. They're probably slightly older than me now, actually. But I wouldn't be surprised if they aren't still running a monkey sanctuary, because they were obviously very happy doing it. So we go from the Daleks of the Liberation Conference to Yangtze University, which was just off Old Street. That was an amazing failure, because it was touted as having no discrimination, no boundary between the teachers and or the people who set it up, the people who were part of this thing that I was trying to get my hands into or trying to become part of, and all these so-called students who, it turned out, were supposed to pay fees. And it turned out that somebody like Francis Huxley, who was on the board of this university, wouldn't actually attend and do his classes once a week unless the university paid for a taxi to bring him from Oxford on the day required, and a taxi to take him back. And it became very quickly apparent that all these names who were going to run this central university, who we'd all sort of queued up to see, wanted the business. You know, they didn't exactly want wages, but they wanted something out of it. Each one had their own little thing that they wanted. And so the thing broke down within the first term, within a month, 6 weeks, something like that, I think it was, in a sort of welter of recrimination. Out of that, there came four or five people, I think it was three couples, of which Diana and I were one, who tried to create an alternative structure. You know, we put a thing up on the wall saying we're going to have a meeting about the trouble that's going on and about this business of boundaries between teachers and students and all the rest of it. But you couldn't get sense out of anybody, really, because, I mean, you had meetings where Lang was appearing, and it was Higgin, you know, Lang and all that business. I mean, he wasn't completely paralytic drunk at that time, but he was having a lot of trouble in dealing with a big audience who were there with multiple expectations. I mean, if you've got, I imagine, and it seems certainly seems so, 150 people, 120 people crowded into an area, and you can see the different expectations for someone like Lang, and those expectations, you know, you have people who were on day release, basically, out of somewhere, and they were very excitable, and then you had other people who just finished reading the book, and it was, the man was crushed under the weight of all this. And so he had a lot of trouble performing. There was David Cooper, whose lectures I tried to go to, who was associated with Lang at the time. He was a South African psychiatrist, but I think he was a psychiatrist, who was trying to do the same thing, but he bought into this story of, in order to help the mentally afflicted, whatever, you have to be there, you have to do it. So he was busy trying to make himself go crazy by any means necessary, at the same time as lecturing to people about how not to be like that. So that was confusing. He went, I think he ended up going potty and killing himself, actually, a few years later. I saw him once or twice walking about in this enormous great fur coat in the middle of summer with a lot of hair and stuff, and, you know, looking like Ram Dass or something like that. Apropos of those two, their contention that schizophrenia, as manifested by the patient at that time, was a process of discovery that the schizophrenia was supposed to be going through, and they would come out the other end and all that, as exemplified to a large extent by Mary Barnes, who'd been Lang's patient, actually, and he passed her on to a man called Joe Burke, who was an American follower of Lang, who was a big roly-poly guy, and a nice enough guy when the times I had in dealing with him, and obviously someone who was trying to make his own path through the anti-psychiatry movement. But he took on Mary Barnes and took on this idea that that if you followed the wherefores of the schizophrenic pathway, you would learn something and you would watch somebody grow and all the rest of it. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that if she was the best example that those people had, of a successful patient and a successful journey through madness, then in my opinion they did not prove their case, because she was not going through something out into somewhere else, except in the sense of being enabled and helped to live her life as a person who was having a lot of difficulty living their life. I mean, I think, I don't know what happened to her in the end. I know she was able to live on her own in a cottage in Wales for quite a long time, and I visited there once, and she didn't seem to be going anywhere that I would call a successful journey through madness or journey through schizophrenia. Now, I don't have a lot of experience of their other patients, so just to build it on one is perhaps wrong, you know. But I was looking for something. I
mean,
I
did the suicides? Sorry to interrupt.
No, go right ahead. Sorry.
There were suicides when didn't somebody jump off the top of the building?
In Kingsley Hall?
Yeah.
Oh, endlessly. I mean, there was all sorts of stuff.
It's not very successful, really, is it?
No, I don't have chapter and verse of all that. You know, I wouldn't want to put it down. A lot of people worked very hard and enabled people to project and create an alternative to the National Health Service, you know, lockups of the time. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. All I'm saying is that Lang was looking for, he was always looking for an ending to everything, I think, that they got involved in. To say, you know, QED, that proves it, I've done this, that shows that this is so. And I don't think they ever managed to really get there. They were always travelling and they never got anywhere. Having said that, I gained a lot through studying their work in trying to understand myself and understand what was going on. I mean, the whole theory of double binds from Bates and you know, Lang, who went to Menlo Park and studied with the American psychiatrists who were just the disciples of Bateson to a large extent. So we had all these people who meant something to the likes of myself. The only way that I could think of interacting with these people was this, through this business of bookselling in the bookshop. So we took this 2,000 quid, got this tenancy on this shop in Camden Town. Diana had 2 weeks' experience working in the publishers. David and Charles, she worked as a tea girl in their publisher's office, and I had a fortnight's experience working as a sort of number two sales assistant in a little bookshop in Camden Passage in Islington. That's as much as we knew. But we also knew that what you did was you wrote to the publishers and you got the catalogues, and you looked through the catalogues, and you had a bank account, and you ordered the books, and, you know, it worked like that. And that's how it did work. It was very simple. You bolt a load of wood and you put shelves up all around your shop, and you fill the shelves full of books to the limit of what you could. And with, believe it or not, with about 1,700 quid and a bit of credit, we got a bookshop that was functioning at that time at 240 Camden High Street, just on the ground floor. And we were very lucky in that we didn't immediately go bust. Diana was the Royal College of Music, and she had a grant, whatever the grant was in those days, it wasn't the law. And I was putting up shelves and running the shop the rest of the time. I do remember that the first couple of weeks' takings, we had this book and it was all written down on every single day. We started off with £2.15 and 7 pence and £1.09 and that sort of thing. And it went along like that for a couple of weeks, a couple of months. And we weren't making enough money to keep going. But she did have her grant, and we were making friends with people, we were getting to know people, and of course this business of cannabis comes into it as well, at around about that time, a little bit later. I do remember the Social Security coming around and saying, but if you carry on like this, you won't be in business. This is because I wasn't buying insurance stamps, you know, neither of us were paying insurance stamps. They didn't tell us. But at that time, you could claim something called a small income exception. If you earned less than nothing, you could tell them that you weren't going to pay for your stamp, and there's nothing they could do about it. They couldn't make you buy a stamp. And we only found out about this in a sort of roundabout way. And when we said to this woman, but what about the small income exception, you know, when she dropped. And they went away and left us alone. And this happened over about 2 years, because our accounts for the first 2 years were negative. You know, we started out with £2,000, at the end of the first year, the net worth of the whole thing was £1,400, and the net worth of the second year was £1,200, that sort of thing. So, but that, in those days, being self-employed was the way to slip through the cracks. It was basically the way to do and live the sort of life that we were looking for, where you were working for yourself. Well, you certainly weren't working for anybody else anyway. You weren't under anybody else's thumb, because I'd done 2 or 3 years of that, and drove them crackers, So we enjoyed ourselves selling books, sort of £3 or £4 worth a day. And we stopped the people, Burroughs, we stopped Trotty, we stopped the books that basically we had read, all that we wanted to read. Even to this day, there's not much more I enjoy than going through a catalogue of publishers of books and looking through them all and saying, what's that? So it was like a kid in a candy store, going through all these British publishers' catalogues and picking out strange books with strange titles and ordering one copy. Publishers go, they don't expect to make a living out of little bookshops they've never heard of. But to give them their due, they sold them to us. We did the business. They phone up and say, you have to have an account to do business with us, don't you? And we said, could we have an account, please? And it progressed. We never really had any idea about doing anything else other than selling new books. I hadn't envisaged the idea of trying to buy enough second-hand books to keep the shop going. It's a very difficult balance to do that, because people you're buying from want a decent price, and the people you're selling to want a decent price. But I think it was more that, as a result of opening a little shop like that, we had access to basically every book in the world. That's how it feels. You've got catalogues. If you come across a reference to something, it's published by so-and-so, you get hold of this thing called the American Publishers Addresses Books in Print, and it's as long as you can afford to buy it from Whittaker's Publishers in the first place, which is sort of 50 quid for two volumes or something, you get an address, and you write a letter, and you say, dear sir, can we have your catalogue? And that's what we did. A normal bookshop has an established lines of supply, and basically they get the books from not that many people, and that's as far as they look. And if somebody comes in and asks for something, I'm going back to 69, 68. Now, it's not quite the same now, because it all works off the machines, isn't it? But in those days, no bookshop was interested in peculiar requests for some book that they... Because you had to do it manually. You had to take these things, these Whittaker things, you had to look it up and find it, and then it was, bloody, I've never heard of them before, So they just didn't happen. So there was a big gap. There was a big gap in the market in terms of service. If somebody came in and wanted an obscure book, and it was certainly the sort of thing we were interested in, then we were interested in seeing the book. I wanted to see the book anyway, so to order it for them was a bonus. We were getting the chance to look at the thing, so we did this a lot. We ordered one or two copies of something. If it looked interesting, we'd order more copies. And so basically our reach spread very wide throughout what was published and what was available. Obviously in England and the English publishers, but also with the American publishers, which is where we actually managed to find a niche that gave us a bookshop that made a living, because you just couldn't get books from America. But the point was that people knew these books existed. People come back from holiday from America, and they bring back American paperbacks with the coloured edges, the yellow edges, pharmacy type store paperbacks, because at that time in America, books were sold as trade books, trade paperbacks, trade hardbacks, proper books, even if they were paperback, they were big, large size paperbacks, or the dime store type paperbacks, just the
Pulp fiction,
thank you very much. The things that were 95 cents in those days, or $1.25 at the most. And those were mostly sold in sweet shops and pharmacists, anywhere you could, it was racks, it was like, I think, in fact, they were probably done like that. I think the people turned up and with a complete rack out of the back of a van and went bosh and took the old one away. And what they hadn't sold, they ripped the covers off somewhere and pulped them, that sort of thing. Because every now and again, you got the chance to buy a sort of sack full of American pulp paperbacks that had the covers ripped off, And somebody who wasn't supposed to sell them would somehow sell them to you or ship you a couple of sacks or something. As we got into basically supplying the American market, we had the very good fortune to realise that there was, starting up in America, were these people who were wholesalers, basically, of the same sort of books, of the counterculture books, the poetry, just the beginning of the big wave of books about drugs, or books about how to do drugs, the green all the green stuff, you know, how to build a yurt and how to build a geodesic dome and all that stuff that was beginning in America, the whole Earth catalog culture, if you like, that culture was welling up in America. There were people who, I suppose they probably had experience in the book trade in the States, but they realized that there were the publishers and there were the shops, and America being the size it is, it isn't a simple matter of going to the trade counter of a particular publisher and picking up a box of their books. You're talking about thousands of miles and all that sort of thing. So America had, at that time, wholesalers dotted about the country who received bulk from the publishers. Quite often, they didn't have much say as to what they got. The publishers published and sent them a consignment of 10 of this, 20 of this, 1,000 of that, each month of what they were publishing. Those wholesalers shelved them and then dealt with individual shops, either by the shops actually coming in and getting them off the shelves, or that was frowned on, or lists, sending out lists, marking them up. Basically connected with various American wholesalers that nobody in this country had even conceived of doing. Now the reason we did that so successfully was basically down to somebody called Bill Butler, who was an American poet living in Brighton, who was actually meant to be the subject of what I was going to talk about tonight. I don't think he probably is. He was would-be poet who was part of the Black Mountain school of poetry, I think, although I don't think he had any direct contact with Black Mountain. I think he was associated with some of the people who were associated with some of the people, you know. And he was part of that American poets, nearly all of them were gay. They knew each other, they were very bitchy about each other, but they had something to say, although I don't, to this day, I don't actually know quite what it was. But I see that as a failing on my part, rather than failing on their part, possibly. I mean, I don't know whether most of you think that poetry's job is to communicate, or the poet's audience is their job to uncover. You tell me, I don't know. But I know that those people weren't busy trying to make me understand what they had to say. But Bill Butler had a bookshop in Brighton called Unicorn, and he had a partner called Mike Hughes with whom he was doing business. I think he had another guy called Richard who he'd been with prior to that who had argued with him, and he'd gone off and started a bookshop called The Public House on the other side of Brighton. Butler had gone to Amsterdam probably seeking his own entertainment and had discovered that in Amsterdam there were two wholesalers, again, of American paperbacks to the shops in Amsterdam that were a bit like some of the Paris bookshops, selling English language books. And these two wholesalers, one of them was called Moonhoff and Bruno, I can't remember the name of the other, but they had franchises from various American publishers to hold stock, pathetic amounts of stock, but nevertheless they had the franchise, to sell these American publishers' English language paperback books in Holland and presumably anywhere else in Europe that didn't speak English, because the business of rights and who owned the rights to sell where, territorial stuff at that time, was owned by English publishers who had the world rights generally, who then sold the American rights to America, who then did anywhere except Great Britain and colonies, because at that time it was still, British publishing was still very much Great Britain and the colonies, and the Americans had enough muscle to buy their own way in and were starting to do what's actually happened since. The Americans have bought into the British publishing to such an extent that I don't think British publishing, in the traditional sense, really exists any longer. You know, all these people like Andrew Deutsch and so on, they've all sold, eventually, they sold to the various Americans. It might be partnerships and all the rest of it, but basically the Americans call the shop. And these days you go into the shops and you see, you're not sure whether it's an English paperback or an American paperback, because you look inside and it says Viking and it says Penguin and so on, but it's what's happened to English publishing. It's sold out, put the money in their pocket to the American publishers. That took a long period of time, but when Bill Butler discovered these wholesalers in Amsterdam, that's what he discovered, at the very beginning of that sort of process. He then realized that you could buy these American paperbacks from the wholesalers in Amsterdam, bring them to England, and flog them to the English bookshops. So that was the very first beginning of the way that the American paperbacks that shouldn't have been sold in this country, because they only had the rights to sell those editions in America, started coming into this country. That was how we got Compendium and kept it alive. we would buy an American paperback for 10 shillings that was only available for sale in England as a hardback book for £3.95 or something, and we were able to sell the American paperback for, you know, 15 shillings. That's the whole ball game of the morality of that, and what the British publishers thought about it. But what we thought about it was that we were on the side of the consumer. We were not on the side of the authors, we were not on the side of the publishers, we were book consumers, and that's what we were doing. We were satisfying the need of the consumers. We were satisfying the need of the consumers, which was very convenient, because that was the way we were going to make our living. It was the only way we were going to succeed. But nevertheless, it's what we were trying to do. And that is how the bookshop grew, and that is how it grew from Diana and myself to what it was in 2001, just about when it closed down. And it went through all those different changes where we had the one shop, and then we had the two shops, and then we had three shops. It was one Christmas where we actually ran three shops at one time. Obviously, we then brought it all back down into one because of various financial difficulties that we had at the time. Bill Butler introduced me to the fact that these books existed in America, that they were highly desirable from the point of view of a consumer of paperback books, of which there was a groundswell. And it just basically turned out that the people like us, there were who wanted to read these things and to whom they meant an awful lot, there were more and more of them. And all we did was we put them out there on the shelf and encouraged people to believe that there was a genre. There was, you know, you didn't want those ones, you just wanted these ones. And that's what Compendium was. And although it grew into all sorts of strange things, that was the policy that we followed all the way through. That attracted like-minded people. The way it grew as far as people who were working there are concerned is there was Indica Bookshop, I don't know if anybody remembers that, in Southampton Row, which had been started by a man called Miles with money from McCartney, Peter Asher, I think, and John Dunbar, a man called John Dunbar, who I think, who was he married? He was married to one of those, was
Marianne
it? It was Marianne Faithfull, was it? Thank you very much. There was that little clique, and I didn't know any of them personally. They were far too ethereal for me to ever get near. That's how I saw it, anyway. But they obviously had access to money, and they had access to the media to a certain extent, and they had, above all, confidence and belief in themselves. So Miles was a very good talker, and at the same time as the International Times magazine becoming started, Miles, who had a foot in both camps, that is to say in the money angle from people like McCartney, and the International Times angle from people like Bill Levy and John Hopkinson, is that his name? Hoppy, the person they called Hoppy anyway. So it ended up with Indica being in Southampton Row, which was the place where that famous exhibition took place where John Lennon met Yoko Ono, you know, that Indica Gallery it was called, and that was upstairs. Desperate to fill it, I mean, basically they had this space and nobody really, you know, there wasn't a lot going on, they had the posters. There was that beginning of that poster industry, which I think probably came out of Lavender Grove, big old posters, and two or three other organisations like that. But they had a room which was just posters, you know, and they were all coming off the wall. It was impossible to get them to stay up all the time. They didn't even have a system for keeping them on the wall properly, you know. So when Yoko wanted that space, or I'm not sure how that actually worked, but anyway, that's what happened. And they just turned up. Well, he just turned up there one day, like they did, you know.
Nick Rochford, founder of Compendium Bookshop in London's Camden Town, talking at the Conway Hall. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM.